morning, tax administrators. Welcome to Tax Breaks, a podcast by the Federation of Tax Administrators. Now, usually, Tax Breaks is recorded in a confidential studio hidden in the depths of the FTA headquarters, virtually in a corner of the internet that no one knows about. But today, we are live on stage at the 2025 Compliance Workshop. Our podcast is for featuring experts from academia, the private sector, and the public sector, and having them share their knowledge with our listeners. Of course, this is FTA's public podcast, so we get listeners from all over the world, from tax professionals to people who are really interested in tax like we are, and of course, to our members in the 50 states, plus DC, New York City, and Philadelphia. A special feature of today's episode is I am joined for the first time by a fantastic co-host, and I've been waiting for this moment for literally years. So I'm joined today, my co-host is Sharon Bernardi, FTA's Executive Director, all-around Wonder Woman, and a couple years ago on stage, Marvel superhero. She gave a great presentation about that. Welcome, Sharon.
Thank you, Ryan.
And we've got a special guest with us today. I think Sharon's going to handle that intro. Sharon?
Yes, good morning. And I have the pleasure of welcoming to our program today Danny Werfel, who served as Commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service from 2023 to 2025. And prior to that appointment, you were the Managing Director and Partner at Boston Consulting Group, BCG, from 2014 to 2023, Acting Commissioner of the IRS in 2013, and Controller of OMB from 2011 to 2013. Wanted to share that Commissioner Werfel holds numerous degrees, including a bachelor's degree in industrial and labor relations from Cornell University, a Juris Doctorate from the University of North Carolina School of Law, and a master's degree in public policy from Duke University. And you and your wife, Beth, have two children, Sean and Molly, and your cat, Emmett, became a social media sensation after being featured on the Internal Revenue Service's Instagram account multiple times. So, please join me in welcoming Commissioner Werfel.
You know, I was intrigued by former Commissioner of the IRS, but now I'm just in awe of celebrity cat dad.
That's true. Well, Emmett, the cat, is the real star here, and I've always known that.
Like all good pet parents.
So today we plan to kind of have a two-part conversation and begin with state tax administration and federal tax administration and then go into a deeper dive into AI. And I know I've been following you and your numerous op-eds, and for others who may not have been following you on social media and the tax media, I want you to please start with just sharing what have you been doing since you resigned your post?
Yeah, so I came out of the IRS on January 20th at 11:59 a.m., but who's counting, right? And what I learned quickly was that what position I wanted to play on the field was increasingly in the area of civics and civics education, and why government matters, why it's important, but also to try to explain, not in a partisan way or a political way, but in as objective a way as I can, using my years of experience and expertise in government, what is going on? What are we seeing? How do we digest it? So it started when there was a lot of uproar over DOGE seizing control of the Treasury payment systems. It extended into questions about the Trump administration eliminating USAID and the legality and the implications of that. Then there were a ton of questions about the IRS, starting with the impact of the layoffs of all the probationary employees, but then moving into other questions of data sharing with ICE or potential threats to Harvard's tax-exempt status. And so my phone was ringing a lot, and it was ringing from people from all walks of life. I had calls from grantees concerned about losing their money, litigators who were looking for advice on how to approach potential litigation to prevent some of these actions, calls from members of Congress asking for my thoughts on what was going on, calls from students at universities working on research papers. Like, people were just reaching out to me. And I found that I had expertise that I could offer, I enjoyed the explainer-in-chief part of the role I found myself in February, March, and April. But more than anything, I started to realize that America needs a civics lesson. That a lot of the questions and the conversations that I was having revealed to me that there was a lot of either misunderstanding or just a lot that people didn't know about the government, what it does, why it's set up. And so I started to think that maybe the position I should play on the field is to be an explainer in chief. And so I started reaching out to universities, and I've landed at two of them, at Johns Hopkins and at Duke, where I am working on a variety of different projects looking at this question of civics and how do we give America a civics lesson and what is the way to communicate to people, whether they be young or old, rich or poor, and given our social media age and where we are in 2025 and beyond, and you know, especially with the 250th anniversary of America coming up on July 4th, I know you all know this. We've come a long way since the Federalist Papers as the way to kind of shape the nation's dialogue about the government we should have. So I'm on a journey now to figure out where we land in 250 years later. Maybe it is a TikTok reel as the way to explain civics. Maybe it's an op-ed in Bloomberg. Maybe it's a combination of a variety of different things, but that's really what my focus is right now.
Well, as a proud Blue Jay and graduate of the Carey School of Business, I think it's also a lesson in leadership. And while you were commissioner, the IRS had one of its best filing seasons, and that is definitely a true accomplishment. And just had a question about if there was one thing that you wish you had the opportunity to accomplish while you were in that position for the second term, what would that have been?
Well, you know, when I got to the IRS, I got there on March 13th, 2023, and we released our strategic plan on April 8th, so just a few weeks later. That was a 200-page plan that outlined all the steps we were going to take to modernize in great detail.
It was a great read, by the way.
Yeah, sure.
As somebody who loves strategic operating plans, like a 200-page, fantastic, yeah. Held up by the fire one night.
I'm sure you did.
Got through it. And it was actually a really clear roadmap for what you set out to accomplish.
Yes. I appreciate that feedback. And it was a lot of what you would want in a plan. Specifics, KPIs, you know, time frames for when things were going to get done, how we were going to measure results. You know, a basic classic strategic plan. But one of the things I realized was I needed an elevator speech. I needed to be able to describe what it is we were trying to achieve in simple terms that I could explain to folks gathered at the Thanksgiving table, and it would resonate. It wouldn't be tech speak or bureaucratic speak, but it would be really easy. And so, and that was one regret I had about the plan, that it didn't have that simple to understand vision statement. And so I came up with it after the plan was released. And it went like this. Our hope, our expectation, is that all taxpayers should be able to do all interactions with the IRS digitally or virtually if they choose. And the reality is because of a variety of different reasons, underfunding, sluggish change journeys that were underway, and we can go down that rabbit hole, we were not there. A lot of what you needed to do with the IRS could not be done virtually, whether you needed to file something, whether you needed a question answered, or whether you needed to see something in your own tax record. It worked very differently than your favorite online banking platform. So Ryan, for example, if you want to go for whatever reason after this event and go on your online banking platform and cozy up by the fire with your April 2023 monthly statement.
You know the way to my heart, Danny. That sounds like such a great plan.
You can do that. It's a few clicks away. But not true with the IRS website and your tax account. So what we're trying to do and what we tried to do was get increasingly closer to that vision where the IRS website or app platform was as effective as the Bank of America platform or name your favorite bank. And I knew it had to be done brick by brick. It meant we had to expand the document upload tool to take more types of documents with more gigs. It meant that the individual taxpayer account needed more functionality, more access points to your tax records. It meant that our entire app platform needed to be updated beyond just where's my refund. And so the plan really was those brick by bricks. And my biggest, regret or wish is that we could have continued the pace that we were on. Because what happens is once you start adding functionality and gaining momentum, you start figuring out how to do it. You know which tools to use. So, the construction starts to go quicker. When you build that first housing unit, it takes a lot longer than the 100th housing unit because now you know exactly what to order and what order to do it in and what tools you need. That's what was happening. And then I feel like on January 20th, it stopped. And all that momentum was lost. Because I do believe that taxpayers should have that modern experience, and that's the direction we were headed.
Well, with modernization, I think, too, you also have the challenges of fraud and increased possibility of fraud. And I know that you were very supportive of the IRS's ID Theft Tax Refund Fraud, ISAC. I was able to serve on that ISAC with former commissioners Koskinen as well as Reddick. And that was, I think, a true model of private partnerships with government and collaboration with feds and state governments. And wanted to just get your perspective on where do you see this type of collaboration in the future? Do you see that the collaboration has been inhibited over the last year? And just wanted to get your perspective.
I think it's such an important point around how we rally as a community, and going back to this idea of resonating beyond the Federalist Papers and talking to people about the importance of tax. Yeah, you have to make it real for people, right? And you have to make sure that they understand what the risks they face, what the opportunities are, and what role a tax authority can play in protecting them or advancing those opportunities. And when it comes to identity theft, I like to think about it and broaden it to tax scams more broadly and exploitation. And we live in a world where it's increasingly risky to engage online for a variety of different reasons. Clicking a link that you're not supposed to click. Responding to a text that you think is the tax authority that really isn't. Allowing people into your computer domain to get access to your private information, opening up those gateways and not really even realizing that you're doing it. And this tends to hit vulnerable populations, the elderly, veterans, people in underserved communities who don't have the means to call an accountant if something seems fishy with respect to something that an email they received or a text that they received. And so this is about basic protection. It's no different than the ability to dial 911 or have the fire department show up if your house is on fire. There's a role for government to play in protecting people from being victimized by criminals and by nefarious actors that are looking to victimize innocent taxpayers and innocent citizens. And the IRS needs to be ready, to just like the fire department needs to be ready or the police department needs to be ready to respond and protect the citizenry. That's one of the basics of government. And in order to do that, it doesn't happen passively. You have to build the capacity to be able to do that. That involves funding, talent, systems, and partnerships. And so my call to action, and I think this is maybe one of the most powerful call to actions that we have in tax today, because it goes to that basic government role of protecting the citizens in ways that no private sector entity has that same responsibility, the police force, the fire department, et cetera. The IRS and the state tax authorities have this responsibility, and it needs to be funded. It needs bandwidth from the current leadership at the IRS. These partnerships need to grow and thrive because it's the constituents, it's the public, it's, if you want to get political, the voters that stand to lose and need the same protections that they need from other types of crimes.
I guess as a follow-up, as you've been doing your research in civics, do you foresee other opportunities for collaboration?
Oh, absolutely. I think, first of all, and this we could do a 5-hour podcast on what people misunderstand about taxation, tax authorities, tax administration. There's just way more false information, misleading information, myths that need to be busted. Just like anything, people need to understand the tax system. There's gaps in tax literacy, but there's also gaps in understanding what the risks are that you face. There's gaps in understanding what rights you have from as a taxpayer from your tax authority. There's a misunderstanding of what we're missing when we don't invest in a modern tax authority. There's a misunderstanding in not understanding what we miss when we don't invest in personnel that can be helpful. You know, I say this a lot. A messy IRS or a messy tax authority does not mean your taxes are lower. You know, the only Congress and the lawmakers decide whether you're going to pay less or more taxes. A messy tax authority means two things. More stress, because if you have a problem, you're going to have a harder time getting it resolved. It's going to take longer, and it's going to sit on your shoulders for a longer period of time, probably with some long lines at the walk-in center, some frustrating waits on the phone, and some mind-boggling, frustrating journeys through a website and hard language to understand. And the second thing it means that you, if you're going to play by the rules, are going to shoulder more of the burden of funding the government than those that don't play by the rules. So it really doesn't benefit you. Your taxes didn't go down. Maybe if you're the type of person or organization that's excited that there's no cops, so I'm going to speed at 100 miles per hour, maybe that's a benefit to you. But most people, the vast majority of people and businesses, CFOs, CEOs, they want to play by the rules. They want to do their civic duty, pay their taxes. They love this country, and they have the basic understanding that while we might be frustrated, we get a pretty good deal for our taxes in terms of paved roadways and traffic lights that work and air traffic control and safe food in our restaurants and you know, you don't have to, you know, worry that you know, if you hop in an Uber or a taxi cab to the airport, imagine a world in which that Uber driver or that taxi cab driver turns around and says, well, that's $1,000. What do you mean that's $1,000? It was a 20-minute ride. Well, that's $1,000. Well, we don't have that in this country because we have mechanisms to avoid price exploitation, and that's all part of a government framework. And people understand, I think, the police and the fire department and air traffic control. I think we have to do more to educate that their taxpayer dollars and the reason why they should be proud and willing to play by the rules, that there are additional, more invisible sometimes benefits that government is providing to them that makes life in America so great.
It's one of the basic principles of civics is that it's a shared responsibility. And as there are gaps in communication or access, states have a responsibility to kind of stand in that gap. Do you have any advice for us as state tax administrators of what we can do to help in this era?
Well, first of all, I would start by saying that there's an opportunity with kind of an IRS that is on a declining resource base to make the case for investment in states' tax authority. There's always sometimes it's a more acute and sometimes less ebb and flow between federal and state responsibilities. Right now, there's a fair amount of volatility, a significant amount of volatility, in terms of the potential for states anchoring more of the burden than the feds. It's not clear yet. For example, there's been discussions of shutting FEMA down and having the states responsible for that type of emergency response. Is it going to happen? We don't know, but there's discussions of it. But when you see what's going on with budget cuts at the IRS and staff reductions, it raises this question. It's concerning as a state tax authority because a chain is as strong as its weakest link, and the IRS is a pretty important link in meeting your mission. But I also think you have to think about it as also an opportunity to argue for more resources, to compel potential talented employees on how the mission of our organization is becoming ever more vital. And it's really, really important that that state tax authorities come together, and FTA can play a role in this, in describing in an objective way, not a political way, but an objective way, of what happens when the tax system is weakened. What are the implications of that for taxpayers and the stress that increases for them on an already complicated tax system? And what happens to the government's bottom line, whether it's the national government or the state government? And so there is a civics opportunity here to not get political, but get very objective on what a weakened tax system means. And we want to protect our citizens and our constituents. And we're concerned that this weakening tax system is causing them more stress, or risks causing them more stress. And it means that those that are playing by the rules are shouldering more of the burden. Let's do something about that. And I think there's an opportunity. Maybe not everyone will be convinced, but if it's done well strategically, there's a messaging campaign, both in your states and more broadly, that will convince a lot of people that aren't convinced today that investment versus divestment in tax authorities is a benefit to them.
That's a really important message, because as we go into legislative sessions and budget sessions, that's something that we should definitely take away in those presentations to our state legislatures. You had the opportunity to serve as acting commissioner in 2013, and then you were commissioner in the Biden administration in 2023. What cultural changes did you observe in the IRS?
Well, the biggest change I saw, maybe more macro, is just the way information in the atmosphere impacts our lives, and especially the media and public relations. So when I was the IRS commissioner in the Obama years, it was right on the heels of the 501c4 scandal, if you will, that led the previous leadership to resign. At the moment I was deputy at OMB, and President Obama asked me to leave my post and go be the acting commissioner to help deal with the crisis of the 501c4 issue. It's hard to believe, but the IRS was the front page story because of that scandal for weeks on end. Weeks. I mean, I could not flip past Fox News when I got home at night and not see my face up there. We were the top story until Edward Snowden knocked us off the top story. So, and that was like six or seven. It took a lot, and that's a big story, right? And it was just relentless coverage. And it really kind of impacted morale. It created risk aversion. There were protests outside of IRS facilities, death threats and other kinds of threats against IRS employees. It was a weight that we had to deal with. Okay, 10 years later, And by the way, it's a real honor and privilege and unique experience to walk out of the commissioner's office on my last day in 2013 and walk back in almost 10 years exactly to the day in 2023 and look around that same office 10 years later, older, wiser, I hope, and knowing and having 10 years to think about all the things I could have done better or differently and now being able to do it. So that was a real interesting journey. But there's a morning where I had a bunch of meetings and I get a text from the head of communications at the IRS. And she says, boss, I know you don't like to be bothered with this stuff before big meetings, but you're the top story on foxnews.com right now. I just didn't want you to hear it from anyone else. And I said, okay, gosh, I can't, you know. So now it's 2023. And God knows what I'm the top, why I'm the top story, but, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm not going to read it, because if I read it, I'll be distracted. I got to put it out of my head. I'll read it at lunch. That'll, you know, so lunch, so I go through my meetings. I do a good job. I don't think about it. I have good meetings. And then at lunchtime, I sigh, get on the computer, foxnews.com. I don't see it. I start scrolling and scrolling. I text my communication. I can't find the article. You're going to have to send it to me. It, in a matter of hours, it went from top story to no longer even findable easily on the front page. And I don't know, algorithms, clicks, the way in which these websites and the news media has shifted, we now have such kind of a fleeting environment. And there's something really challenging about that, but there's also something freeing about it, because any given news story doesn't need, or any given setback or challenge doesn't need to like turn your office upside down for weeks. So I would say culturally, the big change was I found an IRS that was more patient, and believe it or not, more risk preferred, even though it could be more risk, way more risk preferred, still an overly risk averse organization, but it was excited about the funding under the Inflation Reduction Act. It was not an agency resistant to change and modernization. It was, we got to prove ourselves. I used to say this, and this was inspired by the conversations I was having with employees. I would say to inspire the troops, I would say, 50 years from now, people are going to be sitting in this commissioner's office or in the commissioner's conference room, and they're going to say, back in 2023, that IRS got tens of billions of dollars to modernize. It never happened before and never happened again. Did they squander that opportunity? Or did they set us on a course where today we're still benefiting from the changes they made with that money? It's a big burden. It's a stewardship burden. I found it truly inspiring. And I found that I came up with that framework, not on my own. I came up with that framework because I heard it in different ways from employees that were like, we got to make this work. And so I came back to an IRS that was more risk preferred on the spectrum, but still not risk preferred enough, I felt.
I was given thought to when you were commissioner and you visited FTA and gave a keynote at our annual meeting in Rhode Island. And we like to say that states are laboratories of innovation. And during that keynote, you pay tribute to states and how nimble states are and what the IRS could learn.
Yeah, I got
from
my
states.
First standing ovation in Rhode Island at this conference. Because I said the following statement. I didn't expect it to be, I thought it was an ordinary statement, but apparently it was extraordinary. I said, the IRS has a lot to learn from the state tax authorities. And I was like, what did he just say?
I'm going to repeat of that. I guess related to that, and you've been doing a lot of research over the past year, are there any things that you see that are trending that states could adopt or use to just become better at state tax administration?
Well, I do think that states, as I look at the landscape, I think states are out in front of the IRS on using data for fraud detection. That's something that that when I was there, I felt we could be more aggressive our data science, updating our fraud filters, getting more aggressive, like riding the wave of the data science and the AI transformations that we're seeing. I think the states are ahead on that. I think the states have been ahead on plain language and kind of taxpayer-centric views. And, you know, we talk about like making things simple. We've come a long way since the Federalist Papers, but our tax forms still look like they were written in the 1800s or 1700s. But a lot of the states have moved into more kind of like eighth grade level a construct for forms, and the IRS, you know, was trying to do more of that, but that's a place where you get inspired by the state laboratories. I think that in some states there's more like an understanding behavioral science and around compliance and testing different models. That's helpful. I think an area where the states need to open up that lab is back to this question of scams and disrupting the scams and understanding what the risks are. What are the social media trends of bad tax advice and how do we get in front of it? What are the latest ways in which texts are coming across or emails are coming across? What are the fly-by-night operations that are standing up, you know, specious tax shelters that are pulling innocent businesses and others into that we should avoid. This is something where I think the states can help with that type of innovation to be more disruptive and to get the education and the word out.
Well, we know AI is very important to you. I think this is a great segue into the work that Ryan's been leading for FTA in the states.
Yeah, my favorite topic, and one that we were talking a little bit about before we started recording, which is, you know, AI, of course, we, without getting too in the weeds for the listeners, we say AI all the time, but we mean, you know, traditional machine learning, which the IRS and states have been very good at for decades. But now we're getting into this generative AI era, and kind of wanted to start by getting your thoughts with, you know, some of the innovations that you've seen now in the academic world, and as you're thinking about how tax agencies are doing their work, what types of AI have stood out to you as places for experimentation? I mean, we've got obviously examples that the states have been working on, but as a former IRS commissioner, watching this entire landscape, thinking about how technology can make things better, what are those opportunities that have stood out to you recently?
Yeah, I think the way I think about AI, like in terms of going back to January 19th, 2025 and previous when I was at the IRS, I think about it in kind of three segments. The first is, what are the tools that pretty much every employee and every citizen have on their computer right now? Like the large language models that are out there, the ChatGPT, the Copilot, Claude, et cetera. And those are game changing. They're incredible.
Absolutely.
And they have risks associated with them, but they are truly game-changing. And my question, if I'm running an organization, is how are my employees using these tools that are on their desktop? Are they using it to improve their productivity? Do they need training? Do we need kind of parameters? And do we understand the risks in a way that we can avoid the potholes when we're using it? And so, but they're very, very powerful, and they're really, really game-changing and exciting, and they could be harnessed for great things and productivity. The second is there are industry-specific models that start to get developed, where it's like, yeah, can the ChatGPT or the Copilot model do it? Maybe. But this is someone who's actually kind of taught and engineered the model to do like better research for paralegals in the legal space, and I can go through, or better immediate like medical research at a provider, like where the model's really like it goes levels of fidelity, it goes out decimal points beyond what the generic models are doing. And for me, it's like, okay, what are those that I should be looking at my tax authority or my organization that are on the marketplace today that were built for a financial services organization or maybe even built for tax authorities that aren't on my employee's desktop, but they should be? Mm-hmm. And then the third is, where should I have someone come in and build me a model for my organization, for my unique problem, because it's now on the marketplace? And I think an AI strategy should advance in all three of these lanes, that we should be thinking through the I'll call them open source tools or the available tools. Maybe they're $20 a month, I don't know. But the tools that are out there that are just agile and easy and can be in our desktop in moments. And let's pause and talk about that one first, if we could.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's a great framing, those three lanes. And you know, we've published a white paper for tax agencies in the US. We have a public version that's going to be coming a little bit later so that others can see kind of the dialogue that we're having in tax administration about this. And not to bury the lead and kind of to integrate with your points, you know, table stakes here for tax authorities. You mentioned this earlier when, as you and Sharam were talking, data privacy, data security, these are cornerstones of tax administration. We have the single most sensitive data set. A guest on podcast a few months ago said the most intimate data set that you have for any citizen.
Good word, yeah.
Your tax authority has. So as we talk about this innovation, I think it's really important that these are all top of mind for tax agencies. So when you see kind of the public sector, the private sector reports of AI experimentation, a lot of kind of spaghetti being thrown at the wall, some of it's sticking, some of it's not, and then you flip to the dialogue that we're having now about these lanes and that some state agencies are experimenting with these technologies, we're seeing a much higher success rate because of that cornerstone, that responsibility to the data. And I kind of wanted to, I know this was a big focus of yours with modernization at the IRS, outside of AI, is all of these features you want to deliver next generation services, security has to be at the core because you have to trust it.
Yeah, so this is such an important point, and it comes down to me, the, you know, as you're navigating the obstacle course of any modernization or any change. So let's, for tax authorities specifically, as you're navigating the obstacle course of AI adoption, one of the first obstacles you're going to hit is, what are my risks? Do I understand my risks? Because one of the real things that I'm bullish on and optimistic is that the AI technologies that I'm seeing can accommodate those risks.
Absolutely.
Really, really well, surprisingly well. But you got to identify them. You got to know them because so I'll give you an example. I wanted to come back to large language models for a moment. And then do a shameless plug that my December op-ed published this morning in Bloomberg, and it's about this point I'm about to make, mm-hmm. which is large language models have this amazing ability to create a conversation with you. So, for example, if you go on the IRS website and it doesn't have a large language model and you ask it in the search function, what is the filing deadline? What it'll produce, like a Google search or anything, is a series of references. Here's 16,000 different documents that are relevant to your question. So now you go do the research, okay? Versus a large language model, which would say, in response to what is the filing deadline, it would say, the filing deadline is April 15th. Unless you live in Maine or Massachusetts. Because of Patriots Day, your filing deadline is April 17th. Also, we encourage you to check whether you live in an area that's been declared a disaster, because your filing deadline has been moved by 6 months. Here's where you can go to check whether your zip code is in a disaster area. That just saved a lot of time and was much clearer than me looking through 16,000 different documents, right? Now, it's a very easy question, but just, so why not do it, right? And when I was commissioner, we had conversations with other tax leaders around the world. We didn't do it because the risks were not fully identified, the quality control risks. What happens if the model starts moving into providing tax advice in a way that we don't want? What happens if the model says something wrong that the taxpayer constructively relies on? What is the litigation risk of that associated? These are solvable problems. It would be a shame not to introduce this type of solution for taxpayers, but we need to do it in a way that starts to identify the risk and then challenge the model and how we engineer it to avoid those risks. And what I was making the point earlier is that I think they would do a good job. Now, just while we're on it, the broader theme of my op-ed is about the fact that these algorithms that give these answers to these questions, these conversations that are increasingly relied on by students and members of the public and researchers, those are corporate algorithms, mm-hmm. right? And nothing against corporate algorithms, but they're different in their construct. And I have a question in terms of what is the, if I'm an educator, if I'm a teacher, and I give an assignment, if you told me, and this is in the op-ed, if you told me, if this was happening in 1980, and I said, well, where are you gonna go to research the Boston Tea Party? And you said, I'm gonna go to the World Book Encyclopedia. I'd say, okay, that'll be, I have an inherent trust that the process by which those encyclopedias were created, there was a lot of vetting, a lot of peer review. If you go and research how those encyclopedias were developed, not perfect, certainly fallible to potential bias and mistake, but there was a robust, transparent process for how the content in those encyclopedias was developed. We don't have that today. And that's part of what of building trusted models. The tax authorities have to come up with a large language model solution that is vetted and quality controlled. And I think, and this is the point of my op-ed, is that we as a society need that kind of like trusted World Book or Britannica version of ChatGPT that we can go to, that we know that if I ask about the roots and the explanation and the context of the Boston Tea Party, I might get something very similar from Copilot or Gemini or ChatGPT, great. But I know if I go to this, that a series of 27 different diverse academics from all over the world said, yep, this is good.
How do we develop that trust? When you contact a state agency or the IRS, that agent is not going to be 100% accurate. Whereas we expect for AI to give a response with that high level of accuracy.
That's where I think there's positives. Like when I was at the IRS, we were piloting large language models behind the scenes. So for example, if you are an account manager or you're on the phone, you're a phone assistant, and someone calls in with a question and you're like, oh, what does the IRM say on this, the Internal Revenue Manual? And so you ask the system, it'll do what I just said Google does. It'll give you 19 different sources in the IRM versus giving you that cohesive answer. So we were playing around with this. And what we were finding was, first of all, the employees loved it. It was so much easier. It saved a lot of time. And then, scarily, the employers were like, ooh, that's a better, like, I now that I've worked through this question, I used to give a different answer to taxpayers than this one, but this one's right. And so there's a quality control dimension to it. And so what we need to do as tax authorities is realize that the risk is probably less around accuracy, although we have to control for that. We're probably going to improve accuracy over human judgment in those cases. The risk is probably a little bit more about delving out of scope, starting to get the generative models can start getting, you know, like, hey, what about if we do this too? Can I also interest you in that? You know, if you've used these models, they want to be helpful. And in being helpful, they might move into places where, hey, I'm a tax authority. I don't want my large language model going there. I want it stopping right there. Those are the types of risks. We have to kind of draw those boundaries clearly. Mm-hmm. And then, as my point earlier, the AI is much better than I thought it would be. It's really, really, really good at enforcing those boundaries, but you got to know what they are, and you got to train them.
Yeah, well, and absolutely. And to your point about the evolution of the technology, I mean, it's rapidly evolving, and this is almost like your prompt about modernizing the way constituents interface with the IRS, the platforms, logging in, being able to use something like a modern banking platform. But we also have this is like the transition to websites, right? So anybody who doesn't embrace this, calculate the risk, begin moving forward, figure out how to deploy it internally, maybe in some cases externally. These other tools are going to try to fill the gap. We're seeing this with even the best models out there, Gemini, Claude, ChatGPT. People are asking questions of these general models that would otherwise should be asked of a specific model trained by a tax authority.
It's a big news story. It's a big, important thing that should be on the national dialogue. Like, I'm asking Gemini for medical advice, and it's giving me a B-minus answer. Maybe it's giving me an A-plus answer. I don't know. But should there be a American Medical Association trusted version that I can go to? This is part of our immaturity right now with these models and some of the dangers we see. We see it in mental health. These news items have come up a lot, but and that's a really serious issue. But you're also going to see it in tax advice as well. And the reality is that you might find that in certain areas, like certain topics, that the models all lean towards essentially, substantially the same answer, and they're substantially fine. And that's great. But you have to understand within that topic. So in medical, like if you ask it about questions about headaches and common colds, it's great. But if you ask it for orthopedic advice, it doesn't do as good a job and you'll end up hurting yourself more. Like, that's the kind of thing that we need to put the legwork in to understand. It doesn't mean we should avoid these models for medical advice. It means we got work to do. And that's true in tax as well. But my call to action here amongst the tax authorities is not to shy away and expect our risk registers to be perfect. They'll never be perfect, but we need to define them, and then we need to work with these AI solutions because there is an inevitability to it. It's kind of like, sometimes I tell the story, and this ages me, is that on my first day of a real job where I put on a suit and the whole thing, and I, you know, it was like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm my first day of my professional career, if you will. I had a lot of jobs. They were all real, but this was my first time wearing a tie. I wasn't issued a computer, a laptop, certainly not an iPhone. I was issued a dictaphone. That's how old I am. And the way we did our documents is you spoke into a recorder and you walked it to a room of typists, smoke-filled room, by the way. And that's how documents, and that didn't last long. It was like a few months later that the dictaphones were ditched. But where we are today, and every organization in the world went through it.
Yep.
The choice we have is, how do we go through this inevitable move? Do we want to be strategic? Do we want to reduce pain points? Do we want to talk to our employees and gain their insight? There's a journey to go on with AI adoption because it's coming. Like, there's no way to, just like the dictaphone is a thing of the past. Non-AI operations are a thing of the past, but we need to now get ready. And again, going back to my obstacle course metaphor, I start with, let's figure out what the risks are, because the technology will exceed our expectations in managing those risks.
Sounds like another opportunity for collaboration, too.
Well, yeah, that's the other thing about the FTA. It surprised me when I was in the OECD environment with all the other tax authorities. So that version of sitting in a room with all the worldwide, those meetings are great like this. It's like, commissioner, it's good to meet you, commissioner, a lot of that. And there was not only a lack of parity in terms of the Nordics were out doing really cool stuff, but these countries weren't, in terms of like lots of differences, but also not a great mechanism to keep each other informed in terms of, well, I tried that, it failed, or here are the risks that I saw. So when you're building your risk registers, don't do it in your state capitals on your own. Create collaborative councils and committees with clear frameworks for this is what we're tackling from an AI adoption. We want to use large language models for back office workers. What's the risk register? We want to use, and then challenge the AI providers to meet those and to prove to you that they can address those risks down to minuscule risk. I want a large language model for the public. What's the risk register? And then challenge the AI providers. My guess is they'll meet the challenge. I want an AI agent to help my account managers process this return or process this audit to see what the balance due is. Okay, what are the risks? And then invite the AI folks in and show and have them show whether they can do it accurately while also meeting the risk, whether the risk is data security, scope, whatever it happens to be.
Now, this is going to be a continuously evolving space. I think we've got a lot more conversations to have about this in the future.
Well, I had a funny side note. You were talking about OECD, and we recently had a conversation with the Australian Tax Authority, and they had a lot of respect for you as commissioner and IRS commissioners because, I guess, tax commissioners are viewed differently around the world, and they didn't need security, whereas you had protective services. So.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's a badge of honor. I mean, it's just that... Part of it is that we live in a world where tax, we are a very anti-tax world right now. It's interesting. I'm going to make a plug, not for me, but for a close friend of mine. There's a new book out by a terrifically talented woman named Vanessa Williamson. It's called The Price of Democracy. And it is a walk through American history through the lens of taxation and tax policy. And it's what I learned in reading that book was that we were not born anti-tax, we became anti-tax as a country. And as a result of that anti-tax, taxation becomes a flashpoint, and the tax collector becomes part of that flashpoint. And therefore, when people get angry at government or they think about the poster child of the government leader that's not working for them but working against them, they often think of the tax collector, and that creates specific risk for anyone who's leading the IRS in a given moment. That's part of the civics point, right? I want people to understand that we weren't always anti-tax. We evolved that. That's why this book was such a powerful read for me to really kind of... You're all in tax, so you'll enjoy reading a book that really takes this world very seriously and kind of unpacks it from the founding of the nation to the current day. There's so many interesting parallels. For example, did you know that the 16th Amendment of the United States, which created constitutional allowance for the income tax, was a negative response. But the reason why the states ratified it, why would the states ratify a national income tax? Because they were angry about the tariffs. The tariffs were the number one source of revenue, and the tariffs were very unpopular. And that's how the 16th Amendment got ratified, on the backs of the unpopularity of the tariffs. And now here we are today, where the president's talking about we don't need an internal revenue service, we need an external revenue service. Maybe we don't even need an income tax because of the tariffs. These are public statements. So it's just really fascinating to see the full circle journey of where we've been. And it's really important to understand our history to reflect on the debates of today. Probably as Americans are hearing this, they probably don't realize that the income tax was born in the Civil War to fund the war. But it was found unconstitutional later by the Supreme Court after the Civil War. That's why you needed the amendment. But it's really hard to get an amendment to the Constitution, especially one that's giving everyone a new tax. But it was because of the unpopularity of the tariffs, at least according to Vanessa's research, and I trust her research.
Looking forward to giving that a read. I think, you know, I know we've, I could do this for hours. I say that every podcast episode, and I think eventually you hit a limit where, you know, people won't listen to 5 hours of AI and tax conversation. I don't know why. Sharon, I kind of want to get your final thoughts before we wrap up with the commissioner and then see if you have a last question for him, and then we can see if we've got maybe a minute or so to kind of pull a couple strings together.
And I don't know, do we have any time for any Q&A from the audience since we do have a live.
I know we got a live audience. We should at least take. I think we should take two questions, and we'll ask a member of our team. We'll see what first two hands shoot up, and they'll run some mics. But while they do that, I don't know.
If you ever wanted to be on a podcast, this is your chance.
Yeah, now's your shot. And if your question's really good, who knows? We'll do an episode with you. I mean, I'm always looking for guests.
No, I guess what's resonating with me is just the whole civics piece and the personal responsibility that we have as U.S. citizens, as well as what we have as state tax administrators, and the comment around how Europe and other countries view taxation when compared to how some Americans view taxation. And I just know, as a former tax administrator, the importance of the work that we do and the importance of the collaboration that we have with the IRS and all of the departments of revenue in the country, and just want to continue this type of dialogue and conversation and learn from leaders such as you, and want to thank you for your service. I mean, because you are truly a dedicated public servant, and I just want to thank you for that.
No, I appreciate that.
100%. I completely echo Sharon's thoughts. It was a pleasure to have you address our annual meeting shortly after you were appointed. Like you said, first time, standing ovation, room full of tax administrators, friendly audience.
Maybe that's the first time I ever got a standing ovation.
But it was a clear pitch on your vision for
modernization. Except maybe for the kids, when I said, let's ditch lunch and go to McDonald's. That got a standing ovation. But other than that.
And fresh salmon for Emmett, that gets you the loud, resounding meow.
Yes.
All right, do we have a question for Mr. Werfel in the audience? We got time for one or two. All right, we got one right here in the middle.
Thanks, Commissioner. I've heard repeated in various forms on the AI topic that there's a fear that AI is going to take your job. But the way you described it, it mirrors that, is that AI isn't necessarily going to take your job. It's the people that know how to leverage it and want to move forward with it that may take your job or impact your job. And you gave the example of the large language response to maybe like a contact center agent, where it gives them an answer, but it's still the responsibility of the human to be able to deliver that to the constituent. So how do you feel about that sort of angle?
Yeah, I always tell the same story when someone says, is AI going to take job from IRS employees or tax authority? I say, let's go back to April 13th, 2024, 2 days before the filing season. It's a filing season deadline. It's a Saturday. And because we had the funds to do it, at the IRS, we opened about 60 or 70 walk-in centers around the country for last-minute tax questions, Saturday, April 13th. A walk-in center at the IRS in any city or location can serve about 300 people when it's fully staffed between 9 a.m. and 4 p.m. In many of those locations, we had 1,500 people show up by 5 a.m. waiting in line. That means we're turning 1,200 people away hours before we even open. And people were mad. I mean, we had civil unrest at several locations. We need AI and people. Our system is just too big. It's too big and complicated. Even with all the AI fully run and adopted over the next decade, there's still going to be people waiting online, waiting on the phones, unless we dramatically simplify our tax system in America. I don't see that happening. And so, yeah, we need both. We're one of the industries. Some industries are going to be able to put AI in and replace all the people. Some, it'll be a hybrid. Some, and we're one of them, are going to need both.
Excellent. We got time for one more. All right, right here in the front. Great question, by the way. I love the interplay between workforce and AI. It's such a misconception, and humans think creatively. AI surfaces relevant information. You put those two together and it just magic happens. But get our question right here in the front.
There's a famous saying that two things are certain in life, and that is death and taxes. Do you agree with that statement?
Fantastic question, Commissioner.
I have never gotten that question before. I definitely agree with the death part. you know, I will say my immediate reaction is that I don't like the quote because it associates, you know, kind of two inherently negative, death is so negative, it's dark, it's the end, it's sad, we grieve, it's almost always tragic. Taxes shouldn't be that way. I'm proud to pay my taxes, and a lot of Americans are, and as I said, and if you read the book that Vanessa Williamson wrote, you'll see that our entire nation was founded on this idea of taxes are fine. They just need to be fair, right? Taxes make sense. When you go, one of the parts of the book, which I found really interesting, is she takes you out west during the frontier days. And the frontiers folks, the first taste they got of government was the post office and the army. The army was out there building roads. And the frontiers people was like, this is cool. We need stuff like this. How do we get this? Well, you got to pay taxes. Fine. Like, they saw the infrastructure and the importance of it. So I don't think the two certainties in life are death and taxes. I think we need to reshape the way in which Americans understand the role of taxation. They should demand a fair tax system. And I understand the passion that it drives, but a tax-paying public is a more engaged public. It gives them the right to hold their leaders accountable. You can assess, and this is part of the civics, what am I getting for my money? Is that pothole being filled? Is the trash being taken away on Thursday on time? All of that, it creates a good, healthy tension between citizen and government. So I know we're out of questions. Can I make a final comment, which is just to say, thank you for inviting me today. Like, I didn't get to finish my term as commissioner, but I, in both my stints at the IRS, fell deep in terms of my inspiration of tax administration as a calling, as a noble mission. All of you are collectively involved in it. It's thankless. It's no one's ever going to throw a parade for the tax collector or the tax authority ever. I used to compare when I was commissioner that the tax collector to the NFL referee, and I would say when an NFL referee gets the call wrong, 60,000 people stand up and boo. When the NFL referee gets the call right, 60,000 people stand up and boo. When the NFL referee can show on instant replay with AI and technology that they got the call right, 60,000 people will stand up and boo. And that's okay. It's in the brochure. And at the end of the Super Bowl, this amazing event that brings the country together, we're so blessed to have something like the Super Bowl as a fun event, parties, excitement. It generates a ton of money for the economy and jobs. At the end of it, they don't throw a parade for the ref. They throw the parade for the winning team. Nobody asks the ref if they're going to Disney World, right? But you don't have the game without the ref. You just have chaos, right? And that's what we do. We help create the game. We help create the value. We avoid the chaos. We set the rules that allow these things to happen. And we all value from that. And so I was always proud, and my ask is that you continue to have me as a collaborator on the journey of improving tax administration going forward, because I want to be that collaborator with you.
Well, we thank you. And in this room, you will not be booed, but you will be applauded. So I want to thank you.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Werfel.